I'll call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. If members could please take their seats. All right, we have minutes from Wednesday, March 9th, 2005. Representative Nelson moves the minutes from March 9th, 2005. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted from March 9th, 2005. We are going to change the order on our agenda to allow Representative Holberg, Post File 1204, to bring her bill up first because I believe she has a couple other committees to be to. So I will move House File 1204 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there are two oral amendments to the bill, thanks to Mr. McKnight and her eagle eye. The first one would be on page 1, line 18, a comma after the word criteria. And then we also would like that the bill be become effective after enactment.
All right, so I will incorporate into my into the bill page 1, line 18, a comma after the word criteria. And on page 3, after line 6, insert section 5, effective date application. Sections 1 to 4 are effective the day following final enactment. So that is in the bill. Thank you, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to explain the bill?
Yes, please.
All right, thank you. The bill is really quite simple. It does two things. Recently, the Minnesota Department of Transportation has enacted a design build process, and they're finding that current data practices laws do not conform well to that practice, and that it's helpful that certain information be shielded from other applicants while they're making a consideration of the application. In addition, they also need some information shielded while they determine the scope of the project and what the actual request for proposal is going to look like. And we have a representative here from MnDOT that will talk more about that. And then Section 4 relates to something that the Chair is intimately familiar with, and that has to do with the MnPass process and the fact that we need to keep credit card numbers when people are in and out of that section of road, private information, so that we don't have somebody coming asking for a request for data to get the credit card numbers that are used for loading up their transponders, and also to track people's time in and out of that particular stretch of roadway. So with that, I'll let the representative from MnDOT explain the design build process briefly and why we need the first three sections of the bill.
All right, thank you. If you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your brief testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Forsland, and I work for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'm the Data Practices Compliance Officer. And this bill addresses several changes that we support in the Data Practices Act. This first subdivision concerns really internal data on the design-build project. Now, as you may know, the design-build project requires that we complete a design to approximately 30% completion, and then the design goes out under competitive bid for contractors to complete the design. They might even complete some right-of-way road work acquisitions for us and come to us with a complete package of their plans. The goals of using the design-build process are to streamline the time, make it shorter, to increase the flexibility of getting projects completed, and to increase the creativity that contractors can bring to us to keep us at the forefront of the road-building world. when we do this process, there are two items that come in early. One is called an SOQ, Statement of Qualifications. That's where the contractors tell us all the information about their employees, who's who, maybe even what they earn, what are their degrees, what is the each individual employee's experience in this critical design assembly. We create a short list of acceptable contractors based on this statement of qualifications. So we have to evaluate all that information. The second stage that happens is on the short list, contractors submit a technical plan and a price proposal to us. The price proposal is pretty easy, but the technical plan has to be evaluated for design criteria. Does it meet all the design requirements? And does it meet MnDOT's needs for the particular item that's being proposed? Now, in the beginning, when this process started, it was new to all of us, and we have since learned that, particularly at other agencies who've tried design-build here in the local area, data practices requests have been received for the individual scoring criteria before the scoring has taken place. In that first document, the SOQ, we give out a fairly detailed list of scoring criteria. In the example I have before me, there are six or seven different categories, and the weight for each category is supplied. But when we assemble a fairly large team of people to evaluate this, they have a very extensive criteria that looks kind of like this. For each point that's listed, we have a detailed workout of how we would evaluate the submissions. And this is public data currently. And the concern is that companies and contractors will tailor their responses strictly to our scoring criteria rather than to providing us with the flexibility and the creativity that we need, and we'd like to protect that. Same thing happens when the technical proposal comes in. We supply a fairly detailed list itemizing the weight for each point in the evaluation. But when we sit down with our team, we again have a giant system like this where the gradations are established for how we're going to evaluate each point. So we would continue under this change in the law to provide the list of criteria, the weight for each criteria, but we would protect the detailed working out of how each criteria might be achieved. Okay. The second section of the bill.
Ms. Borsland, if you could just speed up the testimony a little bit.
The second section of the bill is mediation. Our affirmative action unit has a mediation process. Complaints of employees relating to harassment or discrimination on the basis of race and gender, we anticipate handling those in this mediation process. Only if the mediation process fails would we turn it over to the standard human resources types of processes under the collective bargaining agreement. This will give us greater flexibility in helping our employees achieve a behavior modification that is necessary to deal with a diverse workforce. Third section is similar to the first on design build. There's a wide variety of documentation that goes into preparing the 30% complete plan. We'd like to keep that away from public scrutiny for the limited period of time between the declaration of a project as design build and the receipt of the technical proposals, simply because our experience has shown that contractors who are familiar with our operations come in and get that information by any means necessary to improve the length of time they have to design. And it gives at least the appearance of unequal treatment for contractors who come in from out-of-state areas. The large national contractors are not as familiar with how we operate and have expressed some concern that local contractors will get better and more information than they can. The final section of the law is about MnPass. This is a brand new endeavor. This is the toll road stuff. We would like to offer people who come into the system complete assurance that their names, home addresses, vehicle identification numbers, and transponder usage would not become public data. We feel that it can be a barrier to participation, and we feel it's critical for Minnesota to obtain good participation in this project so we can evaluate if it's something that Minnesota needs to pursue to help finance the roads.
Thank you, Ms. Forsland. Any questions or discussion on the bill? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't expect to have a question until you started talking about mediation services, and I have a question now about Subdivision 12 where it says mediation data. Why? What data would you save for a mediation? Don't we have laws already that directly apply to the topic of mediation and that it's confidential? And
not as operated by... Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
Not as operated currently by how our agency would like to do it. It's really not personnel data. It's handled separately from personnel data. It could include a lot of things that would not normally be personnel data. It ends up with a signed agreement that the parties sign, and we need to preserve that agreement. It may include things such as the supervisor saying, I will meet weekly with this employee to discuss the reasons, whatever, whatever. You know, so it's a unique type of data. Could be interviewer's notes if they meet with the parties separately and then need to meet with the parties together to resolve an issue.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, this is something unique to MnDOT. It's we do have the State Department of mediation. This legislation is modeled after their policies, but this type of mediation service is not available in that office. So MnDOT has implemented this as a way of working with their employees and hopefully solving the small problems up front.
Okay. Representative Emmer?
That's fine.
Okay. Any other discussion? Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1204 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Broad, House File 271. Representative Broad, would you like to move your bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I don't believe anybody else has requested it at all, so I'll move House File 271 to be placed with recommendation to pass to be placed on the general register.
Maybe we will hold it over for possible inclusion in the elections bill.
That would be fine.
All right?
Thank you.
Okay. And you have an amendment. Is this yours?
I do. DE1 amendment. Mr.
Right.
Chair, can I move that amendment?
Yes, please. Representative Broad moves the H0271DE1 amendment to place the bill into the form that she would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll quickly just tell you what we just did with the amendment. It essentially just changes who takes out the Secretary of State from the way the bill originally was and puts it into the hands of some alternates. But essentially, House File 271 does a variety of things. It requires the nomination of these 8 alternate electors, which is essentially what that amendment has just done, is adding the alternates into the process and aligns the statute accordingly. It also obliges electors to cast their ballot for the presidential or vice presidential candidate of the party for whom they were chosen, by. It also requires the electors to speak loud and publicly affirm in nonverbal or a verbal manner, so there's no mistake as to who they are casting their vote for. And then lastly, the legislation also states that if they fail to cast a ballot for the appropriate candidate, or whether they've abstained from voting, their vote is essentially invalidated and an alternate elector shall be chosen. The bill is essentially intended to guard against renegade electors. 29 states and the District of Columbia bind their electors in a variety of ways. Several states not only bind their electors, but they also issue sanctions on electors if they violate their binded vote. There has been, over the time, 156 faithless votes. New Mexico, for example, has a fourth-degree felony. Oklahoma constitutes a misdemeanor of up to $1,000 for a faithless vote. Washington, there's a civil penalty up to $1,000. Michigan and Utah, there's essentially a resignation from the office upon the faithless vote. Usually, electoral votes are little more than just a rubber stamp. and the closeness of recent elections has shown the need for to formally bind electors so we avoid any hazard of faithless electors and any detrimental effects to our system therein. I do have with me here today, Mr. Chair and members, Jeff Davies, who brought the idea forward to me and has been a great a resource, and I'd like for him to talk about why he came up with the idea.
All right. Thank you. Judge Davies?
Thank you. My name's Jack Davies. I'm here today representing myself, although this idea arose out of my service as Uniform Laws Commissioner. I back when Ross Perot was a candidate for president, I got worried about what would happen in the Electoral College, and I thought that that'd be an appropriate, that the faithless elector would be a good topic for the Uniform Laws Commission. So I sat down and I wrote a bill to put along with my submission to our Scope and Program Committee back in 1992. So this had been sitting in my file ever since then. I finally decided this year, with our experience in Minnesota, that we could at least solve the problem in our own state. And if you do solve the problem in our own state, then I'll have something to take to the Scope and Program Committee next summer, and I'll take another shot at it. The one part of the bill that was not mentioned earlier that I have a little part of authorship in is a fourth page of the amendment, starting on line 14, preserving the function of the elector if the president-elect dies or is incapacitated. That preserves the useful purpose of the Electoral College in that one circumstance. And other than that, I think the bill has been well explained, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Judge Davies' comments, 71 out of the 156 faithless votes actually were because of death of a candidate.
Thank you. Questions or discussion on the bill? Representative Swadley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, if I'm not mistaken, there was a situation, right, during this last election where this did happen. I believe it was in the 4th District. Is that what also why you wanted to bring this forward, or are you familiar with that situation?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am familiar with the situation, and I think as much as we can clarify and make sure that the intent and the intent of that voter was taken into account, I think the public spoken ballot actually will firm up the system, and maybe Mr. Davies has some comments in that regard too.
Judge Davies.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I'm not sure you should blame the 4th District for that vote. There had been a denial that it was from the 4th District. I just wanted you to know that. Actually, Minnesota had an Electoral College experience 4 years ago, as well as this year. 4 years ago, there was a huge snowstorm, and two of the electors didn't make it on time. They were replaced. Then the regular people came, the electors came in, and the replacement elector then resigned, and the original elector was put in place. So it's not unusual. But in fact, this was the experience last fall, where an elector cost Senator Kerry a vote was one of the things that made it a timely project.
Any further discussion? Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad or Judge Davies, I think a lot of people, myself included, think that the real solution to these electoral problems is just to do away with the Electoral College entirely. I was wondering if you could tell the committee anything about the actual history of the Electoral College, or what the presumption was in its creation in the first place, since what this bill does basically is say that the electors have no function. I mean, there's no point in having people show up to form a purely ceremonial service. I mean, if they can't do anything other than what they're supposed to do, there's no reason for them to be there in the first place. We could just say in law that these votes are cast, and we wouldn't have to have electors, and we wouldn't have to go through all that process. But I'm presuming that at some point in their history, there was a reason that the Electoral College was established, and before we'd say that it's totally irrelevant, I was just wondering if you wanted to address that question.
Judge Davies, I don't know if it's possible to answer that question briefly, but we do have a lot of bills. So if you
could a minute and a half to say that I really am very much in favor of having the Electoral College. I think it has contributed actually to the stability of our nation, because in the normal circumstance over the generations, because over that period of time that our nation has existed, the effect of the Electoral College has been to exaggerate the margin of the popular vote, in which creates an image of a larger mandate for the president who's elected. The alternative, if I can guess, a popular election, and maybe in the back of your mind, I think, is just horrendously dangerous. As we discovered in Minnesota in 1962, when we had a statewide recount, and as was demonstrated in the state of Washington this year with its very close election, there's nothing that stands in the way of a dozen or two or three margin nationwide, and that thought of having a recount where some precinct in Louisiana might have control, the integrity of that vote in that precinct might determine their president. I don't want to have anything to do with something like that.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Broad renews her motion that House File 271 as amended be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Elections Bill. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Hilty, thank you. You have two bills, and we will start with House File 470. Representative Hilty moves that House File 470 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And did you have an amendment?
Mr. Chair, I do have one amendment to House File 470.
All right, go ahead.
Which is on page 5, line 23. The sheet that you have before you is not entirely clear where that's supposed to be inserted, but it would be, the line would read, the commissioner must notify those who are the subject of the data.
All right.
That's just a minor clarification.
All right, we will incorporate that.
And I would move that amendment.
Incorporate that into your motion. All right, go ahead, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 470 is a bill that was brought to me by the Department of Human Rights, and I have with me today Ms. Linda Hansen, who is a division director in the department. And I will ask her to walk us through the bill. The bill has three sections that have any kind of significant changes, one dealing with the way charges are processed and the time frame allowed for that. The second section deals with access to closed files and how data is classified. And then there's a repealer of a provision of the time allowed for a finding for a filing based on a finding of probable cause, and Ms. Hansen can explain the reason for that change. Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I would ask Ms. Hansen to walk us through the bill.
All right, thank you. Ms. Hansen, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then walk us through the bill, please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Linda Hansen. I'm the Director of Policy and Legal Affairs. There are changes on page 1, 2, 3, and 4 that are renumbering changes from the Revisor's Office. The first change of substance is on page 2, lines 13 through 17. The Department is requesting this change in relation to work share agreements the Department has significantly with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. There, our work share agreement allows the Department and the Commission to cross-file cases of similar jurisdiction. There are occasions, I should back up, by state law, the Department is required to reach a determination on a charge before the Department within 12 months. There are occasions when we have a case involved in the work share agreement that initial jurisdiction is taken by the EEOC, and their investigation or their determination process results in the Department not receiving the case until long after the 12-month determination. Statutory requirement is reached, so we're requesting that for those cases alone, the statutory requirement to reach a determination within 12 months be waived and extended up to 24 months. The second change in this particular bill is on page 4, lines 33 and 34, as well as page 5, lines 1 through 3. Here the Department is requesting the right, the standing to seek sanctions against charging parties and respondents who engage in frivolous delay in the process of investigating charges. Rule 1470-50 currently allows the charging parties and the respondents to seek sanctions, but not the Department. We would request that the Department be allowed to seek sanctions as well. The third changes on page 5, lines 15 through 24. This deals with the request that the Department be allowed to release information that is currently not public to another governmental entity. That could be a state or a federal entity. An example of that would be we had a request in the last year from the Department of Justice requesting information from one of our closed case files. By law, we were not able to provide that information to them. They had a charge that was similar or the same as the charge before the Department. They wished to access the information that we had already gathered. We were not allowed to give that information to them without a court order. So we're seeking that change for that specific reason. The last item is on page 5, lines 30 and 31. Here the Department seeks to repeal the 180-day hearing provision. This was added to the Minnesota Human Rights Act in 1984 as a measure to encourage the Department to eliminate a backlog of cases being investigated. That need has long since expired, and what the result has been is creating within the Department two classifications of cases, which would be complex and non-complex. So non-complex cases must reach a determination within 6 months rather than the statutory 12-month determination timeline. This causes the Department to give priority to cases that are less complex than more difficult cases. We would seek to have this repealed so that the department can treat all cases that come before the department in an equal manner.
Questions or discussion on the bill? Representative Emmer.
Ms. Hansen, Representative Hilty, I read the information that said this was just a bill that's supposed to make some technical modifications to the Human Rights Act. Did I read that right?
Ms. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, no, this is the policy bill. This is making substantive changes.
So I read the wrong thing then. Why is it, Mr. Chairman? Ms. Hansen, why is it that under Subdivision 14, you're now proposing, or your department's now proposing, adding the language, educational institution also includes religious or denominational educational institution as defined in Section 363A.03, Subdivision 40?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, that's in the technical bill, which is not before the...
Oh, I'm on the wrong one. That's my problem. Okay.
And we are on House File 470.
I think there was a character on Saturday Night Live that used to say, never mind.
Another discussion on this particular bill. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Mr. Hickey, if you could grab a chair. Identify yourself and give us your thoughts, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Hilty, Mike Hickey of the National Federation of Independent Business. We are the state's largest business organization with 16,000 members and very concerned about changes in the human rights law. Unfortunately, nobody from Minnesota Defense Lawyers can be here today. They're the people you really need to hear from, but I'm going to kind of wing it, Mr. Chairman, and share a couple of our concerns and why we're opposed to the bill. And hopefully we can get their input at a later point. Our biggest concern is regarding the extension to potentially 24 months. And right now there's 12. If the right circumstances occur, a file could be open for 24 months, and then finally action would be taken on it. And right now, you know, we do have a one-year statute of limitations. The reason we do is we're trying to get quick resolution to human rights problems and also quality of evidence and dependability of memories and everything else that goes into these claims, especially a lot of it just actual testimony by an employee is critical. So allowing a situation to get to 24 months could be, we think, is a mistake. It's going to lead to more difficult resolution of these claims. It's also going to actually diminish the quality of the evidence in cases where that occurs. Let's say the claim went into EEOC and they rejected the claim. That plaintiff will get a 90-day right to take action initiative from the Department of EEOC. Why would another 12 months have to be put on top of that? And so real concerned about that timeline. It's not a total extension of statute of limitations, but we do think it is going to be problematic and make it harder to adjudicate these claims. Our second concern is regarding the sanctions, and if we are going to increase sanctions, we would like to see this legislature spell out exactly what an employer is going to be hit by and not leave it to the discretion of an administrative law judge or some other judge. Is there going to be a range? I mean, you know, right now it's a new sanction, and it appears to be discretionary. And so our concern is if there is going to be something that would lead to significant monetary damages, we'd like to know what it is. And so those are our concerns. We think this bill certainly needs a lot more input, and we're opposed to it in its current form.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, sir, could you share with me, what is the current statute of limitations for a negligence action?
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what it is. What is it?
I think it's about 6 years. What about a contract case?
Mr. Hickey?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to do well in this law school Q&A here.
Let me get to the point. Mr. Chair, my point is that even for an intentional tort, even if somebody assaults you, deliberately hits you, and you sue them for that, we're talking about a two-year statute of limitations. So 24 months is not at all unusual. In fact, what's unusual is 1 year for the human rights statute. So... Also, Mr. Chair, if I could ask another question.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to that?
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, well, I think it is 1 year, Representative Ellison, for a reason, and that's for the reasons I laid out. There's been many efforts by this legislature over the years to try to extend this to 2 years, and now this is not that bold extension, but in the past the department's come in and fought that because they didn't have the manpower to handle this kind of increase in caseload, and there's also quality of evidence and more difficult to resolve it when you extend that statute of limitations out. So our concern is that some of them are going to fall in to this 24-month window, as it states in the bill summary.
President Ellison.
Mr. Chair, well, when you start talking about quality of evidence, that sounds like lawyer talk, and so that's why I asked you those questions. Well, anyway, my next question is, when it comes to sanctions being determined by a fact finder, administrative law judge, I mean, it's pretty normal for fact finders, the people who review evidence, to come up with whatever the remedy or sanction is going to be, wouldn't you say?
Mr. Hickey?
Representative Ellison, our concern is not knowing if there's any limit. Would there be any limit?
Well,
could it be sky's the limit? Could it be 50,000, 100,000? Is there any potential limit based on this legislation that you have before you?
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, the limit is that the court can only grant remedy and sanction as accorded by law, and that is subject to appellate review. So there's very little danger that we'll have any kind of runaway verdicts or anything like that, because if there are, courts normally limit and change sanction awards and things like that. So it's already built. The issues you're raising, I'm afraid, with regard to sanction, are already built into our system of law already.
Mr. Hickey?
Representative Ellison, that's a chance we'd rather not take. Have it stay with the current law.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ellison.
The chance you're taking is the chance that every litigant in the state of Minnesota takes all the time on every case. So that's all I have to say.
Let me just ask a clarifying question of Ms. Hansen. On page 4, the new language regarding sanctions, am I reading it right? This is not creating new sanctions. It is clarifying what can be in them and then allowing the department to request them, but that right already exists. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The right to request sanctions for charging parties and respondents before an ALJ is already in the rules. The department just does not have the right to bring that request forward.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me see if I can do this one right. Mr. Hickey, listening to you and listening to Ms. Hansen present the bill and listening to Representative Ellison's questions, I brought a question to mind. Representative Ellison was talking to you about how we should allow the courts to do their function. We should permit them to do their job, and yet it's my understanding that this bill, as far as private data is concerned, as far as documents are concerned, this organization, through this bill, is proposing to take the courts out of that decision-making process. Is that a concern to you and your organization?
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, I'm really not able to comment on that at the moment, but we really needed the benefit of the Minnesota defense lawyers here to give us a complete review of this bill, and it didn't happen due to scheduling, but the changes going forward are concerning to us.
Can I just follow up with Ms. Hansen? Then I'll be fair to you, Ms. Hansen. The bill provides that your department will be able to release information under certain circumstances without somebody having to get a court order. In the court order, how many times did that cause a problem?
Ms. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if we're now discussing the closed case files, the change would allow the department to provide information only to other governmental entities. And currently, we can only do that if the governmental entity is willing to get a court order. And this would allow us, or I should say the commissioner, the discretion on a case-by-case basis to determine whether or not he or she wishes to release the information to another governmental entity in order to reduce duplication of effort, time, money, et cetera.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, ma'am, that's exactly what my fear is. And my question to you was very direct in that how many times has this been a problem?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, We probably have a request of this nature by a governmental entity 2 or 3 times during a calendar year.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Hansen, how many times does the department decide not to follow up to obtain the requesting department decide not to follow up to obtain a court order?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't really have any statistics on that. In the last year, we had one request from the Department of Justice. They decided not to follow up with a court order. Mr. Chair, if I could, I would like to address Mr. Hickey's concerns.
All right.
On September 29th of 2003, the department gathered together defense attorneys, plaintiff's attorneys, other interested parties to go over the substance of these bills. They at that time made suggestions to the bills and to this language that we're now discussing today. We have taken some of their concerns and addressed them in the language. The defense attorneys at this meeting did not object to the language that is currently in the bill. The determination extension for only work share cases, which are only cases in this case which are filed with the EEOC, apply to those situations, and I might say on a rare basis, apply to those situations in which the department does not have jurisdiction over the case within that first 12-month period. It's not that we're not meeting the deadline, it's that we don't have the case in front of us. What we're concerned about is on those instances in which the workshare partner has initial jurisdiction past the 12-month period and then turns the case over to the department for investigation. The longer a case is in existence, the more that it ages, the more difficult it is to investigate. So our intent is on those occasions in which we're given a case that has already gone by the 12-month determination timeline, that we be allowed to complete them as fast as possible, but not be held accountable for that 12-month statutory deadline, which we cannot meet in those cases. On the sanctions, as I stated earlier, there is a provision in Rule 1400-70-50, which now allows the charging party and the respondent to come forward and file sanctions with an ALJ. It does not allow the department to do so. Because the department is directly disadvantaged when we have charging parties and respondents who we believe intentionally and frivolously delay the process of investigating charges, the department wishes to come forward. Again, any sanctions would be determined by the ALJ on a case-by-case basis, thus making a fixed amount improper. There may be attorney's fees and costs differing from case to case. This is very similar to Rule 37 of the State and Federal Rules of Procedure, Civil Rules of Procedure, which allows sanctions to be issued by a judge in those cases in which there is a failure to provide discovery. So we're not asking for anything that doesn't already exist. We're just asking for the department to have the right to come forward with that request.
Thank you. Representative Hilty, I think what I'll do at this point is lay this bill over. Maybe the agency can talk a little more with Mr. Hickey or some of the other interests and see if we can work a couple of these things out. So I will lay this bill over. Let's move on to House File 476. Representative Hilty again. And Representative Hilty moves House File 476 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. And Representative Hilty, it looks like you have some couple of oral amendments on this one as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We could address those first. The first one would be on page 2, lines 27 through 29.
Okay.
And this is a clarifying amendment. It deletes a list of possible data and simply substitutes the term government data, which is comprehensive of all of those and I think is intended to not exclude anything inadvertently that might also be capable of being defined as government data. And then on the same line, line 29, we would delete the word gathered and insert the word collected. On page 19 of the bill, we would delete lines 15 through 21, which I understand is simply a revisor's error. It should not be there in the first place.
All right, so incorporated then into your motion are the following changes. Page 2, starting on line 27, delete the words written documents, audio and videotapes, or other electronically and technologically created or transmitted data, and insert the words government data. On line 29, delete the word gathered and insert the word collected. And on page 19, delete lines 15 through 21. We will incorporate those into your motion, Representative Helton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair and members, House File 476 is the Department of Human Rights technical and housekeeping bill. There are some questions, I'm sure, about it. I had some questions of Ms. Hansen when the department brought me the bill, because it seemed that some of the changes in the bill were not merely technical, but Ms. Hansen was able to convince me that, in fact, they were. And so, Mr. Chair, I will afford her the opportunity to do the same thing for the entire committee.
Thank you, Representative Pilkey. Ms. Hansen, if you would like to explain this bill to us.
Mr. Chair, members, in the fall of 2003, the department and the revisor's office undertook a recodification of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. This bill, this technical bill, is part of that recodification process, and going through the bill, or going through the Human Rights Act, it became apparent that over the years, various provisions had been added to the act, kind of in a piecemeal fashion without allowing for consistency in language, and as well as there are some provisions here that are just simply obsolete that have never been taken out of the act. So this bill is proposing technical changes agreed to by the department and the revisor's office to clean up the Human Rights Act and make it more understandable and easier to access and research for those individuals who choose to do so.
Questions or comments? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure, Representative Pilkey, if you want to answer this or not, but on page 4, lines 26 and 27, there's words added, membership or activity in a local human rights commission. Can you tell me what the reason for adding those words into statute would be in that section?
Ms. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this particular section of the Human Rights Act refers to the powers and duties of the commissioner. Clause 15 refers to the commissioner's development of programs for protected classes under the Human Rights Act. As I said, over the years, various protected classes and areas have been added to the Act without updating those sections of the Act that we refer to as the umbrella sections, which should include all the protected classes and areas. This happens to be one of them. It does not add any protection that does not already exist under the Act.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand you correctly, then membership or activity in a local human rights commission is designated as a protected class?
It is, yes.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Is there anyone else who'd like to testify for or against this bill? I had a question myself, but I'm trying to find it now because I was looking at it earlier. And Ms. Hansen, I believe there is a point in here where familial status is inserted as a cause of action for reprisal or reason for reprisal, and now I can't find it.
Mr. Chair, I believe you're referring to page 25.
Thank you. Yes. Can you explain that change to us?
Mr. Chair and members, Section 363A15 is referred to as the reprisal section of the Act. The first change to that section is moving the definition of reprisal to the beginning of that section so that the user, the reader, understands exactly what reprisal consists of. This is, again, one of those umbrella areas of the Act. As you'll notice on page 24, line 26, it refers to the alleged discrimination as a perpetrator. The Department has interpreted this section of the Act to apply to all protected areas, all protected classes. As protected areas and classes over the years have been added to the Act, this section, again, has not been updated to reflect those. Current practice within the Department is that reprisal applies to all protected classes, all protected areas. This change simply reflects that practice.
My question is, I didn't think familial status was included as a protected category in the employment section, but I may be wrong. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, familial status is not a protected class under employment. However, this section of the Act is not referring to just employment. It's referring to everything that's included under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So there are, for example, in housing, does not include the protected classes of age and local human rights commission activity. But yet, for those other areas of the Act where it is applicable, reprisal is considered to be a actionable charge under the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
But Ms. Hansen, then, if this would apply to reprisal in the employment context, would it not?
Only in those areas, Mr. Chair, in those areas in which, only in those protected classes in which are applicable to the employment situation.
All right. I guess I would have a concern because I would, if I were an attorney, I may make the argument that familial status is listed as a cause of action for reprisal, even if it's not listed specifically as a protected category in the employment context. So that concerns me a little bit. I think that sends a mixed message.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we did not include familial status in this section, then that would perhaps under the way that you're understanding it, mean that in housing, which is the only area in which familial status is applicable, would not be open then to a reprisal charge, and that's certainly not our intent either.
I understand your dilemma. It concerns me that it may broaden the statute, in my opinion. Representative Elson?
Please forgive me for not having read this particular bill as carefully as I should have or could have, but it looks to me, Mr. Chair, that this is under Subdivision 4 of the real property. This is real property transaction. That's where I see familial status. Is it changed in other spots in the bill as well?
Ms. Hansen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, the only area that familial status is applicable under the Human Rights Act is in the area of housing. What we're referring to here is the section regarding reprisal, which is, again, an umbrella section. It applies to not only housing, but employment, public accommodations, public services, education, credit, and business.
Right.
So any protected class would be, and protected area would be, found under the reprisal, only as it's applicable to what protected class is allowed under what protected area.
Right. Mr. Chair, so in other words, familial status is just that you can't not rent or not sell housing to people because they have kids or because some family member. That's basically the idea behind
this. Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
And that's well recognized in American jurisprudence today, right? In every state and under the federal government. Is that right?
Yes,
and in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct. I don't know every law of every state in the United States, but yes, it's an accepted practice.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hansen, now back to what I wanted to talk about earlier. And I've got a couple, three questions, Mr. Chairman. Do I understand correctly, then, that the phrase I read from page 2, that's already somewhere else in the Act? It's just being moved, and I'm looking at lines 21 through 23. I assume that's what Representative Hilty was referring to earlier.
That's correct. Ms. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, lines 21 through 23 are a directional device. There is much confusion under the Minnesota Human Rights Act regarding educational institution versus religious or denominational educational institution. Those three lines simply indicate to the reader that there is a definition regarding religious or denominational educational institution, and it's found in that particular subdivision. It's found under 03, subdivision 40. So we're just using that language as a directional so that those individuals who are accessing the Act will understand that there's more than just educational institution found under the Act.
Representative Emmer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My question, Ms. Hansen, again, was those exact words, do they exist somewhere already in the Act? Because you're putting them under educational institution. You can call it directional or whatever you want. My question is, under this provision, the definition of educational institution, is this language already in existence in the Act?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it is.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I tend to agree with the chairman's concerns about the familial language, since I do think you're expanding the law, not further defining it. And I've got a similar concern on page 3 in line 11. You've added the word procedures, or you propose to add it. What procedures are we talking about? That seems to be an expansion, Ms. Hansen.
Ms. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, procedures refer to those procedures that are required by state law. For example, the department must comply with Chapter 13, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. We have a procedure that the department follows in-house to make sure that we abide by that act.
Mr. Chairman, then I would propose there's no need for it. If it's already covered elsewhere, then it just seems to be superfluous, if I could say the word. The next question, and my last one, is on page 4. And actually, this is a two-part question. The first part is at line 17. How much is that going to cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative, not one thin dime.
Ma'am, Mr. Chairman, ma'am, it says provide staff services. That's not going to cost anything?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're moving the language from what was Clause 17 under Clause 13, where it is related to Clause 13. So we're not adding anything to the Act. We're just changing the order of the order in which it's reviewed and under the Act.
Okay.
Representative Emmer?
Last one. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hansen, throughout this technical bill, it appears that you've added the term credit. Is that already in existence, or is that something new? Is that one of those things that was outdated, that had to be updated? And how is that going to work with private institutions? You know what I'm? Do you understand my question, ma'am?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do. Credit has been a protected area under the Act for many, many years. I can't tell you exactly when it was enacted. But I believe it was enacted somewhere in the 70s or the 80s. We're not adding anything to the Act in that area.
Senator Emmer?
I think that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Lynch, were you looking to testify? Please step forward and identify yourself. And members, I feel like we're going in the same direction probably on this bill, Representative Hilty. But maybe what I'll do is allow the testifier to testify and probably lay this bill in front. Ms. Lynch, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Teresa Lynch from Dorsey & Whitney, and we represent the Minnesota Employment Law Council, and they raised a concern with this bill on page 6 and 7, the language regarding settlement negotiations and disclosure of the settlement negotiations, the language they're concerned about is found on page 7, which is prior to final resolution. And what they're suggesting is if you are allowed to disclose the settlement negotiations after the resolution, it might still put a chilling effect on the negotiation process.
Any questions for Ms. Lynch? All right, Representative Hilke, I think I will lay this bill over as well and ask the department to do whatever it can to work with some of the questions that have arisen, especially since it's a technical bill. Representative Broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was going to ask if I could, Ms. Hansen, if I could get some information. Could you provide me a list? I'm sure our researchers could come up with it, but I'm sure you have it at your fingertips of all the protected classes and commissions that would be underneath that.
Ms. Hansen's
I don't need it today.
Right. Could you provide that to the committee and we'll pass it out to the members?
I can, yes.
Thank you.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you. All right, I will lay this bill over. Thank you, Representative Hilke.
Thank you.
And Ms. Hansen. Representative De La Forest, House File 1325.
Somebody forgot. All right, Mr. Chairman, we're good. We got the microphone fixed here finally.
All right. Representative De La Forest moves House File 1325. He recommended to pass and re-referred to public safety. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission here and your leave, I would like to offer an author's amendment.
Please.
To get the bill into the form in which I'd like to discuss it. The amendment is as follows, page 1, line 21. After the word loss, insert period and strike the rest of the sentence.
All right. So Representative De La Forest moves that line 24 after the word loss, insert a period and strike the rest of the sentence. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, you may miss right. Just to be clear, line 21. I think you said line 24.
I'm sorry, line 21. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, good afternoon. I'm pleased to present House File 1325 today, which is admittedly a rather modest bill and certainly is not complex in its length. What it does is it provides, in those cases in which there is a controversy regarding certifying a class or failing to certify a class, that that certification or failure to do so can be appealed to the Court of Appeals in a much quicker fashion than what is currently the law. As members could read on page 12, line 12 would be 30 days. Furthermore, during the pendency of any particular appeal, discovery and other proceedings would be stayed, save for an order of the Court of Appeals that that it is necessary to continue discovery. On subdivision 2, Mr. Chairman and members, we inserted a requirement that in order to be a member of a class, that there must be some type of loss. And what this is so much, admittedly, there can be a line drawing issue, but I want to make it clear that the public policy should be that there should not be a presumption that any particular person is a member of a class, but instead there must be some modicum of an ascertainable loss. I also have with me today here Mr. Chairman and members Mike Rothman, who is an attorney practicing in this area, and before standing for questions, I think it would be helpful to have him testify, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Mr. Rothman, if you could identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon. I'm Mike Rothman. I'm an attorney at Winthrop & Weinstein. I practice in insurance law and regulation. I have a litigation practice, and I have litigated class actions. I'm a member of the bar of both California and Minnesota. I have a membership in the federal courts at the district level in Minnesota and California, at the federal appeals level, and the United States Supreme Court. I'll focus my remarks on the first section of the bill. Presently under current law, the only avenue available to appeal a class certification order is discretionary review under the appellate rule for petitions for permission to appeal from an interlocutory order, and that's Rule 105.01. Generally, under Minnesota law and is interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, interlocutory appeals are disfavored, and ordinarily only final judgments are appealable. Consequently, appellate review for class certification at the interlocutory level or stage of a case is on an exceptional basis and not the norm. And those are the words of Minnesota Supreme Court. There are several concerns that justify expansion of the present opportunities to appeal. First, if an order denies class certification, then the plaintiff's only sure path to appellate review is by proceeding to final judgment on the merits of an individual claim that, standing alone, is far smaller than the cost of litigation. In essence, under the current standard, a plaintiff can only get an appeal in the interlocutory fashion only if a questionable denial is the death knell of the case. On the other side of the coin, on the defendant's side, if an order denies certification, then the defendant may be forced to settle rather than incur the cost of defending a class action and run the risk of potentially ruinous liability. Here in Minnesota, only if a questionable grant places inordinate pressure on the defendant to settle can you get an appeal, and there's an important question of law. Moreover, in the long run, expanded appellate review will enhance appellate court scrutiny of class certification orders made by the trial courts. The goal is to ensure uniformity of decisions made by the trial courts throughout Minnesota to deny or grant class certification orders. In the end, with expanded interlocutory appellate review at the beginning of a case, that is, trial courts will apply class certification standards as set forth in Rule 23 in a more consistent fashion.
Thank you. Did you have other testifiers, Representative DeLaForest?
Yes, one more, Mr. Chairman.
You could identify yourself for the record and give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mark Calda. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I am here today based on my experience watching the class action issue for a number of years. Prior to my employment at the Insurance Federation, I was a television journalist and a news manager for a number of years, including a couple of years where I was a consumer reporter in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I began watching the class action situation. And I come to notice that too often these days, the class members, the consumers who are supposed to be protected, are actually victims of the trial lawyers, because while the cases are settled, the trial lawyers make millions of dollars in fees when the consumers get virtually nothing, coupons or checks. And I want to give you a couple of examples of cases that I was personally involved in. The first one was a number of years ago. If any of you were credit card holders of Citibank, Citibank is one of the largest credit card issuers in the country, and a number of years ago, there was a class action suit against Citibank alleging that they were posting their daily payments at 10 o'clock in the morning, which seems like a reasonable time, but somebody determined that perhaps 1 o'clock in the afternoon was a better time to post the payments, and there was a class action suit on that basis. And because Citibank is a large credit grantor, there were literally tens of millions of members in the class. And so when the case was settled and the attorneys got millions of dollars in fees, the consumers, of which I was one and maybe some of you were as well, we received checks for a nominal amount of money. I received two checks. One was for 69 cents and one was for 29 cents. So because of this alleged violation, I received two checks that I didn't even cash. In fact, one of them wasn't even worth the price of the postage that it took to send it to me. The second case I wanted to talk about was a case based in Hennepin County District Court. A Minnesota company named Arcadia Financial several years ago was sued in a securities class action, a case where the company was accused of delaying by several weeks the release of some financial information, primarily because the company was in the process of being sold at the time, and because of the due diligence, they needed to spend their time providing information to the potential buyer, and they didn't release their information in a timely manner, and the price of the stock went down a little bit by about 20 cents a share, and there was a lawsuit based on that. And in that particular case, the attorneys received about $2.4 million, and the class, which was about 2,000 shareholders, of which I was one, we received a coupon for $200 off of a future car loan from the company. Arcadia Financial is a subprime lender, and that's where you need a little context on this. They grant auto loans to people who have questionable credit, and the interest rate for those loans are sometimes upwards of 20%. so you could get the coupon for an auto loan for $200 off an auto loan where the interest rate was 20%, or you could go to your bank and get one for a lot better deal. And I would submit to you that I guarantee you almost none of those coupons would probably be turned in. The attorneys in the case, when you do the math, received about $1,000 per shareholder in fees, but the shareholders themselves received a coupon for $200. And the other thing to think about in that particular case is just because you're a shareholder of a company doesn't mean you're a customer of the company. And that was my case. I would never be a customer of the company. I was a shareholder. What would have been a better settlement for someone in my position would have been for the money. And we didn't get that. In fact, that case was so egregious to me that I actually went into court and I asked to appear on behalf of the class to protest the settlement. And I found something that was a little bit unsettling to me, and that was that the system is really on autopilot in certain cases. What I found was that the case was presented to a retired judge who didn't know very much about the company, didn't know very much about what its business policies were, didn't know very little about the actual settlement itself, other than it adhered to law, and therefore he agreed that it should go through when I thought that it wasn't very fair to the shareholders because we ended up getting a coupon that to us was probably worthless. And the third example I want to give you comes from last Thursday's Minneapolis Star Tribune. On page A13, there was a quarter-page ad in another case against companies that produced laminate countertops, Wilson Art, Formica, et cetera. And actually, I'd purchased one of these countertops a number of years ago, so I'm actually in this class as well. And this one is a little unsettling to me because they explain in here that setting up the actual class and paying it out is going to be too complicated. And so they actually admit here that they're going to sue, and they've already got $5.2 million by two of the four companies that they're suing. But they admit here that it's going to be so difficult to actually administer the class that the class members aren't going to get anything. So they're actually going to donate the money to charity in that case. And so those are just a couple examples of cases where I think that the consumers these days aren't really being benefited. They're actually victims. And I urge strong support of this bill and ask you to pass it. So at this time, I stand for any questions.
Questions for Mr. Rothman or Kolda, Representative Emmer.
I do have a question for Mr. Rothman, but I'll preface it by saying my understanding is that we were here to talk about a logical change in the law that deals with interlocutory appeals, not to bash trial lawyers over the services that they might provide. And with all due respect, sir, when somebody pays $5 million, there must have been something wrong that forces that issue. We're darn lucky we have people that are out there pursuing claims against folks that would try to cut corners and abuse the system. With that being said, this proposed law, I noted that it has a 30-day right of automatic appeal. And my question, I think we talked about it briefly beforehand, was under our current system a few years ago, the courts tried to streamline it because we had several different deadlines. So they just made a blanket 60-day, and I think you were explaining to me the difference between federal and civil court in these claims. If you would just explain that again, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Roth. The 60-day standard that you're talking about is the general right of appeal standard. What this does, or what this is meant to do, is to provide a shorter period of time of the appeal, because it's at the beginning of the case, essentially, so that everything happens quicker. Under the federal rule, Federal 23F, you can appeal, and I believe the rule, I can be corrected if I'm wrong, is a 10-day rule. You have to file within 10 days. And then the opponent has an opportunity to file a response within 7 days. It's meant to be quick so that at the beginning of the case, there's less prejudice to either party, really, so while the appeal is pending, so that it happens much more quickly.
Representative
Forrest. If I can, Representative Emmer, were you done with that kind of question? Okay, sure. And I just want to add a comment here, Mr. Chairman, in the interest of the committee's time as well. I think that certainly we could have a very passionate and spirited debate over whether or not class action is a good thing or not, or whether or not it's being abused. And I just want to make clear that my bill does not attempt to address those kinds of issues. To give you Representative Emmer, for example, what I was thinking in drafting this bill is first of all, I think it is clear on both sides of the debate that class certification is an extremely important decision point in this type of litigation. Once a class is certified or the failure to certify, the dynamic for settlement, for example, absolutely changes. It changes exponentially. And when you look at under the current system where you can continue to expend judicial resources and the resources of both the parties, I mean, there's significant potential savings and economies that can come in certifying the class or appealing it sooner rather than later. So, again, you know, the purpose of this bill is to simply deal with one aspect of procedural law within class actions and not to say that they're a good thing or a bad thing overall.
Representative Simon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just echo Representative Emmer's comments, too, and I appreciate Representative LaForce that you made that comment. I think that, and sir, what's your name?
Mark Hulda.
Hulda, is it?
Hulda,
yeah. I mean, I just have to say, in the interest of the committee's time, I won't also go off on an extended rant, but the oldest trick in the book is to talk about the 50 cents that consumers get and what a waste this is. None of us would disagree that if a company or anyone, any defendant, has done $10 million worth of damage to one person, that one person would have every right to sue. But suddenly, when it's $1 of damage being done to 10 million people, suddenly it's bad. The fact is someone has benefited or someone has defrauded, and whether it means that 10 million people were damaged $1 worth or one person was damaged $10 million worth, I think that's a real, you know, it's a ridiculous argument. But let me just say, as to the second section of the bill, Subdivision 2, and maybe this is more for the author, what is the purpose for that? Why should we attempt to define the class in a way apart from what Rule 23 already does in our state and in many other states and just says as long as you have a common question of fact or law? Is it, do you think it's necessary or is there some...
Representative LaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, it is a good question, but to go back just a second for Section 1, and again, you made the point about having particular damages. I know you weren't even with us in the legislature here last session. This is a bill that did pass out of this committee and went to the General Register last session, and that we had a dollar's worth of damages in Section 2. And I came to the conclusion that was not the best public policy for the reasons you stated. You could have 10 million people with 95 cents worth of damages, and just because it's 95 cents worth of damages, for example, should they be denied the possibility of a class action suit? I came to the conclusion no. And so what we tried to do in Subdivision 2 with ascertainable loss is, again, in our jurisprudence, this is an area where we have problems line drawing. I mean, it is. It's difficult. And Mr. Rothman, I'm sure, can add much more to this from a legal perspective than I can. But my thought was first twofold, public policy. I think that there can be a presumption in the courts too often that classes just get certified without a lot of scrutiny. And I thought it was important to at least say in statute there should not be an automatic presumption, for example, that a person should be a member of the class. There should be some ascertainable loss. And admittedly, that's a low threshold. I have tried to avoid intentionally trying to straitjacket the courts, if you will, and leave flexibility to the courts with a hope also that, much like in the consumer fraud statutes, that over time you can get a body of jurisprudence to build up and sort of get a settled definition of what it is. So at least from the author's perspective, one who does not practice in the area, in fact does not practice law anymore, that's what I was thinking with Subdivision 2.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Villafort. So do I take it then that your oral your oral amendment, which got rid of the words of money or property, real or personal, is it your conclusion then or in your judgment that this subdivision as currently before the committee would allow for a class member who has suffered some sort of intangible loss, such as maybe the loss of the right to vote or some other civil rights-related laws?
Representative LaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Simon, you're correct. And actually, the hypothetical I spun for myself, for example, you could have a class action with respect to sexual harassment, for example. And I thought there was a possibility that it may be construed by some that maybe a case like that or a loss of the right to vote, that would be precluded under this bill. And that was not my intent. And so that's why I had that language stricken.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair. Representative LaForest, I appreciate the amendment that you made because that was exactly a concern I had. You know, if somebody loses their right to vote, then what kind of dollar figure do you put on that? Who knows? But I think your amendment might lead us toward fixing that. My concern is that you can appeal a class certification right now, and it can be accepted by the Court of Appeals, and the defendants probably can prevail. It's just discretionary. It's not automatic. It's something that, you know, you can make the appeal and the court can either accept or deny the appeal. And I think that's a good way to go. That's the way the feds do it. And I'm not sure, and if, you know, and if we're going to do anything, I could go along with maybe adopting the federal rule. And I'll say that the federal courts are by no means friendly ground for plaintiffs. You know, you got to earn everything you get there. So, you know, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't just leave it discretionary. And then also under the federal rules, it is a 10-day, not a 30-day. I'm not sure why, you know, we need to extend to 20 more days beyond what the federal government already allows, and if we were going to make a change, maybe we could model the federal rule, which could make sense. So those are some concerns of mine. But my main concern, and you can address them in any way you want, my main concern is why should simply filing a notice of appeal stop discovery? I mean, would you be willing to strip that part out so the discovery could at least continue on and that you couldn't simply just put the brakes on discovery just because you file a notice of appeal of a class certification question? Is that something that you could entertain? Because I think that we're just wasting time by doing that. I mean, there's no real reason to stop discovery, and perhaps one of your testifiers has a reaction to that.
Representative Gilchrist. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ellison, at least a lukewarm endorsement of this bill coming from you. I'll take it. I'll take it.
Yeah, as a matter of course, you can't do that. It's a jurisdictional issue. As soon as its notice of appeal has been filed, jurisdiction shifts to the Court of Appeals. So there should be no further activity in the at the district court level.
But well, I don't know what the procedural thing for me to say right now is. But under the federal rules, discovery goes right on. If you file an appeal of a class certification, and so, you know, I mean, yeah. But the thing is that we're proposing to change how interlocutory appeals and class certifications are dealt with, and the federal rules allow discovery to continue on. You agree with that, won't you? You can read the rule. Read the rule.
Members.
Okay.
We can talk later.
Okay, yeah. We'll talk it over later, Mr. Chair, but if I could just go on with my question. I guess that's my first question. Why should we cut off discovery? Why 30 days as opposed to 10?
Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Rothman probably can do best at shedding some light on these questions.
Mr. Rothman.
I don't have, Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I don't have the rule, federal rule in front of me, but I did look at it before I came here. Under the federal rule, the staying discovery is discretionary in the first instance with the trial court. So what in effect would happen is you would file an interlocutory discretionary or an appeal for discretionary review with the Eighth Circuit in this state. And you would then have to file a petition to the district court to stay discovery. And then discovery would be up to the trial court whether or not it would proceed or not. You could then petition the Eighth Circuit to decide whether or not the decision to stay discovery was appropriately done or not. And the point of the federal rules is, the way the federal rules set up, is to really make the trial court make the decision on discovery in the first instance. The only difference under the proposed law change would be to shift the burden, basically, to basically say there will be a stay of discovery, but that the parties can be a motion to have discovery continue. It's really who's going to seek the motion, who's going to prove it. And fundamentally, it'll resolve down to the same kinds of questions. And the real issue beneath it all is whether or not discovery should continue or not, whether or not it's a waste of the resources of the parties, whether they should continue to pursue discovery while the class certification motion proceeds up. And usually that happens in the context of parties wanting to obtain testimony of witnesses, if there's spoliation of evidence, or if there's some prejudice that might be incurred if discovery is not continued. This, as written, would still allow those basis for discovery to be proposed. It's just a difference of how it's structured on the, under the federal and state rule.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Here's another question I have, and perhaps Representative Emmer will have some ideas on this too. Can we even do this? I mean, how come the Supreme Court can't simply say, this is a procedural thing, this is our business, you guys, this is not for you to do? What, can we legislate in this area?
Mr. Rothman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, I believe so. Under the federal law, there's a federal statute on what law, what appeals are interlocutory or not. And the federal rule for interlocutory appeals, for example, 23F, is based on that statutory authority. And I believe it's the same, that the legislature has the ability to legislate in this area, that in essence the legislature can establish procedures for the courts. Often it does.
I'd like to ask Mr. Carlson to come forward and give us his thoughts on the bill. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. We have some concerns about House File 1325, and you were just getting to a couple of them. I maybe would just start with that. As a general matter, we feel that courts are in the best position to determine its own procedures. In fact, I direct the committee to Minnesota Statute 480.0591, which specifically reserves to the court the right to their exclusive right to determine their procedures, and reserves to the legislature certain evidentiary matters that they may interfere with. But generally, courts are in the best position to determine their own procedures, and as was referenced, that's how the federal courts have handled this, through a specific federal rule. We believe that House File 1325 is a solution in search of a problem. I'm handing some information out to the committee, one of which is from just March of this year. It's the United States Chamber of Commerce Institute for Legal Reform 2005 State Liability Ranking Study. And in there, I would direct the committee to note that Minnesota, according to in-house counsel, Minnesota has the seventh best and most favorable climate for business litigants in the country. And the states above us, if you happen to look on page 7 of that executive summary, are the well-populated states of Nebraska, North Dakota, Iowa, and of course Delaware tops the list, as they are the corporate home to more companies than anybody in the world. That is the state to incorporate in. But more specifically, I passed around a sheet that lists just Minnesota. And some of the issues that the Insurance Federation were talking about, be surprised to know that Minnesota ranks third in the country on judges' competence. We have a highly qualified and effective judiciary, and we also score very well on discovery, the handling of scientific and technical evidence, the timeliness of summary judgments and dismissals, and a number of issues that that business thinks Minnesota ranks in the top. And what we have now before us is what we think an excursion into the province of the courts on an issue where none exist. After the federal, after Congress passed the Class Action Reform Bill in January, most class action cases are going to be transferred to federal district court. I would venture to say that you're talking about less than 10 class action cases that would remain in Minnesota after the passage of the federal class action reform bill. And the same groups that were demanding that reform in Congress are now here saying we want a different rule than what the federal rule provides for handling of class actions. And just you've hit on most of them, Mr. Chairman and members in the bill, but the federal rule provides for a discretionary appeal only. It does not allow for an appeal as right. and that is to, we believe, to eliminate frivolous appeals. You know, not every appeal or motion that is filed in district court is done for meritorious reasons. And we believe that a mandatory appeal without discretion and coupled with an automatic legislative stay of discovery, which is not consistent with the general rule, is simply an opportunity to delay an action where there may be underlying liability. And that appeal could go on for a long period of time. And we think that that is moving in the wrong direction. I would also like to add, Mr. Chairman and members, and you have talked about it, and I believe that the amendment helps, although loss is not defined. But in Subdivision 2, Minnesota allows class action litigation for injunctive and equitable relief. And we believe that without a definition of what an ascertainable loss is, you may very well be precluding civil rights class action cases, workplace discrimination, sexual harassment cases that proceed as a class. And we don't believe that that is consistent with the court rules that we have right now relative to class certification in Minnesota's Rule 23. The last point I would make, Mr. Chairman, and then be happy to answer questions, is just on the effective date, you know, there may be cases that are currently proceeding to court under our current rules, and I would suggest this effective date is retroactive. It's been a well litigated point, and that if you were to make a change in the effective date after it commenced, you may want to consider from incidences occurring on or after that date. So this is purely a prospective rule and does not impact any litigation that is either in the process right now or conduct that's happened in the past. Mr. Chairman, be happy to answer any questions. You know, to the extent this patterns a federal rule on how interlocutory appeals would be allowed, our objections are mitigated, but this far exceeds that and places legislative hurdles on what has been the province of the courts, and we think it is not based on merit that is before you, based on a problem that is being seen in our courts. And the issue of coupon settlements, you know, this does nothing for that. And if a consumer gets a coupon when they've been defrauded by a company, we're not here to necessarily defend or promote that practice, but it's clearly done when there has been harm caused to the consumer. And we don't know what the background is for those particular settlements, but we do know that it's our belief that there's underlying liability, and that's why a settlement is being reached. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Any other questions or discussion, members? Otherwise, there's no other witnesses on the list. With that, the Representative Villaforos will renew his motion to pass this bill to public safety. House file 1325. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Parent. Opposed, same sign?
Aye.
Motion carries. Motion carries. Division has been requested. All those in favor signify by raising your right hand. Opposed, same sign? Motion prevails 6-5.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Ellison, House File 1566. Representative Ellison, I understand the motion will be to move this to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Elections Bill.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Shall I proceed?
Yep, go ahead.
Members, I don't have any testifiers today. In fact, I think this is a very common sense, straightforward bill. If you have any apartment buildings in your district, or if you may have in the near future, you'll know how difficult it may be to get campaign material to people who live in apartment buildings. And right now, as a candidate, you can go there and you have the right as a candidate to go there and distribute campaign literature, door knock, do election campaign work. But when you start seeing a lot of campaign apartment buildings, it can get out of control, and you may need to have some of your helpers go there on your behalf to either drop literature or door knock for you. And in those cases, this law change, proposed law change, would allow you to do that. Right now, you couldn't do that. You'd have to be there personally. Now, law always provides for the requirement of people showing ID when they show up at the apartment building. The law already provides for having to sign in and give information, even get prior notice. But I think that people, and bottom line, people who live in apartment buildings have just as much right to receive campaign information as the rest of us, just as much right to be harassed by campaign workers as the rest of us, and we should allow people to go into apartment buildings wherein the candidate is not necessarily present, but makes adequate provision therefore. This bill it's already in law, that the apartment management can require prior notice and identification. There's no proposed change there. That's a good piece of legislation. We're glad it's there and want to keep it there. All this does is allow you to be somewhere else while your campaign staff is helping you campaign in apartment buildings. So that's what the bill is. That's what the bill does.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ellison, any questions? Otherwise, Jack Horner from the apartment housing. Representative Dean. Question while Mr. Horner gets ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison, would this also allow opponents equal access to apartment buildings as well, let's say, or disassociated groups from a campaign to either campaign for or against a certain candidate? Is there any provision that these folks have to actually be associated with your campaign, or could they, in fact, be out to get you?
This bill would require that the campaign workers be connected to a candidate. If you look on lines 15 through 18, it's clear that this is with a candidate. And in essence, Representative Dean, people can act as your surrogate if you're not standing there at the apartment building. You can simply get prior approval and allow them to go there, but they can't be any free agents just going out and making mischief.
So Representative Ellison, on that, what if a group decided to say, well, I'm going to be out for Representative Ellison, at least that's what we'll say we're doing. Is there penalties in there for that?
Mr. Chair, there should be, because that would mean they'd be lying, and I think that they should be held accountable for that. But that's the risk we run in just about anything that we regulate in this building. People can always misrepresent the truth.
Sure.
But the thing is that, no, these folks are supposed to be connected to a candidate, and again, the building is, the management of the building can require prior notice and can also require that they sign in and show picture ID.
Okay. Mr. Horner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack Horner, representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Chair, members, a couple of points. First of all, our concern is that it opens up apartments, condos, co-ops, nursing homes, all the types of multi-housing listed in the statute, essentially to anyone who would claim to be a worker for a candidate. And candidates very broadly defined, any candidate for nomination or election to federal, state, local, county office, special taxing districts, townships, school districts. And anybody can come and say that they are working for a candidate and claim right of law to enter the apartment. Our problem with that is that there's no real accountability. When a candidate is there, you know who he is, or you could easily find out, or he or she is. And in that rare case, when something goes wrong, someone leaves a mess, someone leaves campaign literature, it's possible to find the person, you know who they are, and there's just kind of an aura of accountability. under this our bill, our fear is that anybody could enter, whether for registering votes or dropping lit or for whatever purpose, or for non-campaign related, commercial salesmen attempt to get into buildings with regularity. It could be anyone who is claiming to enter in that regard. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to keep in mind that, after all, these are people's homes. The hallways and the common areas are not public space. Apartment residents and condo owners, homeowners, think of themselves as being at home. And even though they share parts of their home with other people, they are, in fact, in their own homes. And when you're through the front door, when you're in a hallway, you've really entered that person's home. You've already gone through the first line of defense, if that's the issue. You're now knocking on the inner door of people's homes. They tend to be alarmed. And so they often get down to apartment managers. Apartment and condominium managers hear all the time from folks who say they're concerned about a lot of traffic in the hallways. They want less traffic. They don't want more traffic, is what our folks hear. And what the responsibility, I think, of proper management is for the convenience and the safety and the well-being of their people. Finally, Mr. Chairman, one last point, and probably the most important one. I don't think that this bill will resolve the author's concerns. We don't think it resolves the problem of access. There was talk about condo and apartment owners and managers who maybe are hard to work with or don't let candidates in. First of all, I should say that the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association supports the current law. We did when it was a bill, when it was introduced. We like the candidates in the buildings. We think it's right that the candidates be in the buildings. At the same time, in my own personal experience and in talking with members, I think it's fair to say that in almost all cases where there's access to multi-housing, either by the worker accompanied or not, or by candidates, that ordinarily you don't go through the process, the legally mandated process. It's really quite informal. You either just walk in or I've done it myself. You ring a doorbell and someone lets you in, or you just walk in. I think in most cases there's not that kind of an issue. Our problem is when you expand the law, and after all, keep in mind we're talking about the force of law to enter people's homes, it seems to me that there is a very real danger of just solidifying that opposition. Those people who might tend to oppose or be hard to work with anyway, certainly greatly expanding people coming through the apartment, people knocking for appointments, people trying to get in, is not going to do anything to make them easier to work with. We support the law. Every election cycle we send out to our people. I can see the chairman is ready for me to stop, and so you got the gist of what I want to say. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Horner, Representative Hilty had a question for you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question isn't really for Mr. Horner, although I think that many of the questions that he raises are more about the current law than about the proposal that Representative Ellison has brought before us. But Representative Ellison, it seems to me that part of Mr. Horner's objection and part of the concern that I've heard expressed about this would be easily resolved if we amended your bill slightly to say on line 16, after worker, if it said worker authorized in writing by the candidate.
I'll make that motion, Mr. Chair, for that amendment. I'll move that amendment.
That's a friendly amendment?
Yes.
To roll into your bill?
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion on the friendly amendment? I think if it's friendly, we can just incorporate it, but we'll vote on it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Any other discussion? Members, this is being laid over for possible inclusion. So,
Mr. Chairman, I have a sort of a final wrap-up remark.
Go ahead, Representative Ellison.
I just want to say that the question is, should people who live in multi-housing be treated the same as those of us who live in detached housing? I'd say they should be. I'd say that If you can go right up to somebody's detached home and drop lid or knock on the door, I think people who live in multi-housing ought to have the same right. And I think that if and given the amendment, they're the concerns raised by opponents, I don't think really represent any sort of a serious meritorious response to this. And so I do hope when the time comes, you support the bill.
All right. All those in favor of Representative Ellison's House File 16.
I thought we were going to lay it over.
Oh, I don't need to vote on that. Yeah, we'll vote on laying it over for possible inclusion. So, House File 1566 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Bill is laid over. At this point, there's no other business. Meeting's adjourned, members.